Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Real Recognition Radio, a program designed to promote a positive work environment. Your hosts are Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. In this hour, you will be motivated to motivate, increase morale, productivity, loyalty, and reduce turnover. Learn how some companies get it while others don't. Now, here are your hosts, Roy and Max.
Welcome to Real Recognition Radio, the show that's all about building relationships, inspiring greatness, and creating a workplace where people can thrive. I'm Max Brown, along with my colleague Roy Saunderson, and we're from the Recognition Management Institute. Roy, I'm excited about the show today. How about you?
Oh, no kidding. I think we've never kind of had this whole focus on leadership and trying to get beyond that kind of glass ceiling that for women and putting this together with gratitude. I'm pretty excited about the opportunities to go deeper on this.
Well, I am as well. I think this will be a fun conversation for many, many reasons, and I'll introduce our guest now, Whitney Johnson, the founding partner and president of the investment firm Rose Park Advisors, the Disruptive Innovation Fund, and a Harvard Business Review blogger. Prior to co-founding Rose Park Advisors, she was the Merrill Lynch's senior telecom and media analyst for Latin America. As a sell-side equity analyst, she developed expertise in valuing publicly traded securities and in analyzing how management can create or destroy value. She was rated by StarMine as a superior stock picker vis-a-vis her peers and became an institutional investor all-star within a year of becoming an analyst, an honor she was accorded for 8 consecutive years. Her specialty in Mexico, where the stock she followed accounted for roughly 40% of Mexico's market capitalization. In 2005, when she left sell-side research, she had earned a coveted double ranking in the Institutional Investor Survey, number one in Latin America media and number two in Latin American telecoms, and was widely considered the act on stocks under her coverage. So, Whitney Johnson, we are grateful you're here. Thank you and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, as Roy mentioned there, just prior to introducing you, to talk about the ceilings or women in leadership and then to expand that conversation around gratitude and characteristics of leadership. I mean, just lots of stuff today. So to begin this whole journey, if you would you mind telling us about your own career path and how you started in the financial industry?
Happy to. It's a very circuitous route. In fact, I would say that I could really be considered a poster girl for girls or women that don't know what they want to be when they grow up. I graduated in music from college, BA, and arrived in New York actually at the ripe old age of 27. It took me quite a while to get through college, but once I got there, my husband was working, actually pursuing his PhD at Columbia University, and I had to work so that we could eat. My first instinct was that I wanted to do something in Spanish because I had studied Spanish in college and lived abroad for several years, and so wanting to do Spanish, I actually ended up on Wall Street. Now, I didn't know what Wall Street was, and because I was a music major, the best job I could get was working as a sales assistant for a retail stockbroker. What then happened was that I started to look around me and see that, I think I'm as smart as all of these other people that are Ivy League graduates. I think I want to work on Wall Street. And so
Wow.
Started taking classes at night. I worked very hard. I persisted and persisted and doggedly pursued my boss, asking if they could promote me. And eventually, I had a mentor who was willing to put me or jump me from what is often an unbridgeable divide from the secretarial or administrative track to the professional track. So that is how my career began about two decades ago.
I mean, fascinating, absolutely fascinating. And then, like you said, to be the poster child for women looking for something and might not know what they need to do. Can you explain how important it is to have someone like that in your life, someone that's willing to take a chance on you, a mentor, if you will, to let you bridge that divide?
It's huge. In fact, it's interesting. There's some research that's put out by Catalyst, Inc., which is a think tank-type organization for women, that says that the person or our very first boss really makes the difference over time in our earnings potential, and I think gets us off to a solid footing within our career. And so having people who, at critical points in our career, particularly as we start out, who are willing to push us to raise our bar, to excel, and to believe that we can is absolutely vital.
My goodness, as you describe that, I'm thinking it's basically the definition of any great leader, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, I love that. You, Whitney, with your background in the financial industry, I wanted to get your opinion today on this most recent financial crisis. If there was any way to describe it, even one or two sentences, what would you say?
That's a tall order. Let me see if I can take a stab at it. I would say, I'll try to do it in four words, but then I'll elaborate. Reckless abandonment of ethics. I think the financial markets have become so arcane and in some ways not real. It's almost like playing World of Warcraft or some other computer game, that it's really easy for this transacting that's taking place to feel like monopoly money. And I think then when you add in the observation that was made by real estate investor Craig Hatkoff out of New York, he said we've securitized Adam Smith's ideas. And what I mean by that is that Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, which is a manifesto for capitalism, but he also wrote the book The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And we've now become a nation that's no longer people with clients, but we now have counterparties, with capitalism really separated out from any sense of ethics. And I think if people want to do more reading on this, there's a really brilliant article by Michael Lewis, who wrote Liar's Poker two decades ago, but more recently wrote a piece called Beware of Greeks Bearing Bonds, which gives you a sense of what happened within one country, but I think it's a microcosm of what's happened throughout the world in terms of this idea of separating or securitizing our sense of ethics from capitalism.
My goodness, it's a heavy topic because of how close and recent it was for many of us, but I fear that people are already forgetting it, as if it couldn't happen again, because I don't know that anything's changed. It doesn't seem like much has changed, at least from my perspective. What would you say?
I think that we have short memories, and that's a bad thing. Because we do, the expression, those who don't learn history, I'm paraphrasing, are doomed to repeat it.
Yes.
So that is a bad thing. But on the other hand, I think there is a sort of boon to having short memories, because we tend to be eternally optimistic, and I think that's a good thing as well. So I wish that we would remember, and I wish that we would put in place controls and sort of moral compass types of controls, but it won't necessarily happen. We can only really change ourselves.
Well, I love that you would make that distinction, actually, between the short term and why the short term is actually a pro and a con. I do appreciate that. What do you think about in terms of the role women will play in leadership and in the impact of the future workplace?
Well, first of all, I would say it's inevitable that we will play an increasingly important role. I don't know if you remember the report that was put out by Maria Shriver in the Center for American Progress a few years ago called A Woman's Nation. And just to give you a couple of facts, mothers are now the primary breadwinner in 4 of 10 families, up from 11% in 1967. And according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, women in managerial ranks is swelling. It just reached 51.4%, double from 26% in 1980. So we know that there will be an impact. Now, what that looks like, we just don't know yet. I think that it's pretty safe to say that there will be more of an emphasis on a work-life fit, but how it will turn out, I'm not sure. Now, one of the things I'm obviously concerned about, and I wrote about this in one of my blogs on HBR, which is Venus may be rising, but don't neglect Mars, meaning if women feel that we have been powerless for decades in the workplace, is there a risk that as we wield more and more power, that we, instead of being bullied, become the bullies? And I think that is certainly a risk, and that men get stunted. And what we need to have is both men and women running on all cylinders. That's when we really become effective as a company, effective as a nation. So I think we need both.
Well, it makes me wonder: is the problem actually power as opposed to gender? You know, because we have seen people, regardless of sex or what have you, that once they accede to a certain level of power, that actually becomes a downfall, or you know, this hurdle that can't actually be overcome. They become a tyrant, if you will, whether they're male, female, whatever.
Yeah, I agree. I think it power is a problem. Power corrupts, and so the question is, we always have to keep that in check. I guess I'm just thinking about this in the context of the question, what happens when you've got women who have been out of power? If they have more power, what does it look like? And so mm-hmm. I don't know. Let's hope it doesn't look bad.
Right. I've reflected on this myself in a blog post where I said, you know, I wonder if the financial crisis would have occurred had we had more women in place. Not that I have an answer, but simply to say, is it worth considering that might have had an impact? And I wonder, are companies with women leaders performing better compared to their peers even now?
Well, I think it certainly could have had an impact. There's been some research, and let me just give you a couple of different data points. One professor, David Gaddis Ross, out of Columbia University, studied organizations that were inclusive women in top management, and what he found is that these particular organizations have a 35% higher ROE, or return on equity, and 34% better total return to shareholders than their peers. And there have been other studies, for instance, out of the University of Michigan and one out of the UK just last week, that provide strikingly similar figures. Now, correlation does not causality make, but I think the numbers suggest that there is something to be said for having more women in an organization, not fewer, and I think we need to figure out why it matters and then how do we optimize the mix of men and women.
Well, in about the last minute and a half we have before we have to go to break, is it possible to share maybe some of those characteristics that women bring to the table, or the characteristics that help them make them successful as they climb?
Yeah, I think, well, some of the typically feminine strengths, and this has been somewhat controversial, but this is what I espouse, and it's from Carol Gilligan, who wrote a book called In a Different Voice probably 30 years ago. But I do think that there are some distinctly feminine characteristics like interpersonal connectedness, care, sensitivity, responsibility to people, all of which I think are very important. And in an increasingly flat world, to use Thomas Friedman's phrase, these qualities, the ability to collaborate, I think will certainly come into relief. Now, the caution that I would give to women in particular is that we can't use just these skills. We need technical skills, really robust technical skills. And so it's not an either or, it's a both and.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't do one without the other, basically.
Right.
Okay. Well, my goodness, we have to take a quick break, but it's already going way too fast. But when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Whitney Johnson. You are listening to Real Recognition Radio on the Voice America Business Channel. This is Max Brown and my colleague Roy Saunderson. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit facebook.com/VoiceAmerica or search for us at keyword Voice America.
How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
Relationships are the core of great businesses. Your employees are critical to the success of your business. Rideau helps you build positive relationships with your people. Rideau helps you inspire greatness in your people. We do it through the power of recognition and rewards. Rideau's clients are Intel, RBC Financial, Boeing, and Liberty Mutual. We're committed to our clients and our people. Together, Rideau and our clients create better workplaces, better businesses, and ultimately, a better world. Become a Rideau client. Find us at rideau.com. Rideau is the proud sponsor of Real Recognition Radio. Up-to-date business and financial news. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. The experts are here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about, getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Real Recognition Radio with myself, Roy Saunderson, and Max Brown. And our guest today, Whitney Johnson, president of Rose Park Advisors and a Harvard Business Review blogger. Whitney, as I heard those comments, I've been writing all kinds of notes down, and it's important, I think, for our listeners to be able to kind of get a sense for the impact that women can have, especially in this light of the recent business crisis and financial crisis we've gone through. And I would like you to maybe just share with our listeners the story of Brooke C. Bourne, who was the former chair of the Commodity and Futures Trading Commission, and she attempted unsuccessfully to campaign the regulation of the multi-trillion dollar derivatives market, whose crash helped to trigger the recent financial collapse. Why do we kind of fear those who bring these kind of opposing ideas to what seems to be the norm?
Well, Brooksley Bourne is a very, very interesting figure, and I don't know about you, but I had never heard of her until a couple of years ago. So let me tell you a little bit about her and set the stage. She was the first female president of the law review at Stanford, first female at the top of her class, an expert in commodities and futures. And she was brought in by the Clinton administration to run, as you said, the Commodities and Futures Trading Commission, or the CFTC. Once she got into this position, she became aware of the over-the-counter derivatives market, which was a rapidly expanding and very opaque market, and she attempted to regulate it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem is that when she went into Greenspan and Robert Rubin and Larry Summers and asked for regulation, they shut her up and shut her down, in the words of Tim O'Brien, who was then a reporter for the New York Times. And I think their rationale was, the economy is thriving. We want it to continue to thrive. There are a lot of people that are making a lot of money off of derivatives, and nothing's going wrong, so let's just let it ride. And she was not one of them. She was an expert at what she did, but she wasn't part of the team, if you will, and I think it was very difficult for them to hear something that they didn't want to hear from someone who they didn't perceive as being one of them.
She wasn't one of them, so the ideas were not resonating. How do you break that barrier?
Well, I think that what we need to be aware that we have that bias, that when there are new ideas that come along, that we are likely to not listen to them. There's a great... And knowing that, then start to say to ourselves, okay, so if I get an idea that I don't necessarily agree with, what am I going to do with it? And if I do listen to it, how will it be beneficial to me? So in particular, there's a paper that was written by Clay Christensen and Paul Carlisle on theory building a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And they said, quote, it's only when an anomaly is identified, an outcome for which theory can't account, is there an opportunity to improve theory, end quote. And so the way I think about that with respect to our lives, our careers, et cetera, is it's only when we encounter something that we don't know how to do or an idea that is foreign to how we're thinking about the world do we have the opportunity to become a better person. So I think if we have that mindset that foreign object is not something that's going to hurt or harm us, triggering a flight or fight response, but instead mm-hmm. something that will help us improve, then it will be easier to hear it.
Wow. So it really does mean keeping a very open mind to all viewpoints in this way.
Yes, but as you and I both know, that is very, very hard to do. And
yep.
I think the first step is to recognize that we are going to have a tendency to reject disconfirming evidence and also be aware that that we're much more likely to hear it if we trust the people. And so that's why when we're delivering feedback within the workplace, if we think about the times when people have been able to receive feedback from us, it's because they trust us mm-hmm. and they know that we're only delivering that feedback because we want them to be a better employee. It's not meant to hurt them or harm them or to demote them, but instead it's constructive and to help them, you know, improve.
And do you recommend any kind of strategies or methods to be able to build that trust effectively in today's society?
Wow, that's I could talk about that for a long time. I think it starts from the time that we first hire someone, that when we hire them, we know, or they know, that we fundamentally have hired them and that we are not just going to pay them, but that they have a job with us and that we are invested in them and their career. And when they know that very fundamentally, and we have to feel that way, people will know if we don't. So when
right.
you make a hire, if you believe in them and their career enough that in a year's time they said to you, I am going to leave because I've gotten this terrific opportunity, instead of being upset, you will be happy for them.
Mm.
Then I think you will be able to, it certainly that has been the case for me, that I can deliver pretty much any feedback that I need to, potentially quite negative, because they know it's absolutely about them and coming from a place of furthering their career, and there's no ego, if you will, in trying to aggrandize myself. It's all about them.
Okay. Now, you know, I resonated with you in a recent blog entitled The Long of Coming Up Short, because we share the same passion of avoiding calculus when we were in school. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that story and the impact that failure makes on our lives and why that's important.
All right. Well, let me just tell you the story really quickly. So when I was a senior in high school, up to that point, I had a, 3.9 GPA or 3.94, something quite high.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't take calculus because, and I almost didn't take AP history because I was afraid I couldn't get an A. And in retrospect, because I pursued a career in finance, it certainly would have been a lot better for me to get that B in calculus than not to have taken calculus at all. But I was so concerned about getting anything less than that, which for me really would have been tantamount to an F. So it was a very binary approach to the world. It wasn't I can get an A, B, C, D, or F. I'm going to get an A, or if I don't get an A, it's an F. And that was just too risky for me as a 17-year-old.
My goodness. So was that an important learning curve?
Yes. In fact, so much so that now any time I speak to young women that are in high school or in college, I really encourage them to take calculus and to take the hardest classes that they can. In, you know, if they're getting an MBA, don't just take the, you know, soft classes, but take the corporate finance classes. Take the classes that really push you, because then you'll have technical skills that will further your career, and more importantly, you'll have the confidence that you can come up against something really tough and know that you can come off conqueror. And conqueror doesn't mean an A. It just means that you showed up and you did it and you learned the material.
Oh, wow. That's a completely different focus than what most people tend to go into education with, isn't it?
It really is. It really is. And there's another quote that I love. It's from the New York Times that says, "Tell me the stories of your scars, for your scars are signposts of optimism." And I love that as well, because then you can kind of look at the scars on your body and think, oh, that scrape on my knee or that scar on my chin is because I tried something and I failed, but I got up again and I kept moving forward.
That is freaky. I can look at a scar on my right index finger from falling out of a tree on a piece of glass when I was about 10, and I still climbed that tree. So that's a story. All right. Well, listen, you've shared some wonderful stories even through your blogs, and I know one was about your experience in your early career and about the way two particular bosses treated you, and you can appreciate from our love of leadership and recognition, you kind of share the impact that appreciation had on performance. Could you share that with our listeners, please?
I'd be happy to. I'll give you the negative example first and the positive example second. First off, let me set the stage again for this. One of the things that I've found in some of the research that I've done is that, and this was in the post, Toot Your Own Horn, Gender Bias, that if women point to our accomplishments, we're often considered self-aggrandizing. Mm-hmm. And if we don't, and in extreme cases like on The Celebrity Apprentice, yes, I watched that show, gold medal Olympic swimmer Summer Sanders, she got fired because she wasn't willing to point to her accomplishments. Actually, later in my career, I found that many of my accomplishments were perpetually being co-opted by the team. So I would accomplish something, and then they said, good job, team, but I wasn't really getting credit for them. And so out of frustration, really, at one point, and that was perhaps a mistake, I went to my boss, and I said, here's what I've done, and I articulated it for him very clearly, and his response to me was, why are you so self-promoting? Can you just do the work and not talk about it? As you can imagine, that was very discouraging for me, and not incoincidentally, I left the firm probably within the next year and a half to 2 years. Now, another boss who was several years prior to that at Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, he challenged me to really set my game or improve my game as an equity research analyst. And when I did, he acknowledged my contributions both to me and to the team informally, and then he did so in writing as part of the formal review process and paid me accordingly. And not surprisingly, my performance by any metric that you can measure improved substantially while he was my boss. And so that small investment in his encouraging me and setting the bar high, and then when I met those targets, saying, you did it, atta girl, there was a huge ROI for him and for the firm.
Wow, that's a wonderful sharing there, Whitney. And I think we all know that when we're fully appreciated, there is continual evidence that our performance can be elevated in the workplace, in education, and obviously in the home as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, listen, it looks like we're due for another break. I can't believe how fast this is going, Whitney, but stay with us. And for our listeners, come back in just a few minutes on Real Recognition Radio as we continue to delve deeper with Whitney Johnson about leadership and the power of gratitude. For Real Recognition Radio, this is Roy Saunderson and Max Brown.
Stay connected. Sign up for our newsletter. Go beyond your favorite Voice America shows. Visit iradioblog.com.
How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
The next generation of employees is more sophisticated about recognition. They want to make a difference to their organizations, to their environment, and to their world. Rideau offers a full suite of recognition and reward solutions tailored to meet our clients' needs strategically, technologically, and globally. Rideau's clients are Intel, RBC Financial, Boeing, and Liberty Mutual. Together, Rideau and our clients create better workplaces, better businesses, and ultimately, a better world. Become a Rideau client. Find us at rideau.com. Rideau is the proud sponsor of Real Recognition Radio. Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now. Toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about, getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and myself, Max Brown, and of course our guest, Whitney Johnson, president of Rose Park Advisors and a Harvard Business Review blogger. As a matter of fact, Whitney, I remember finding one of your blogs and reading more about gratitude and just saying the regular thank yous on a normal basis. And as you were sharing with Roy earlier, what a profound difference it was in your life based on the way your manager treated you. And that's how I connected with you, and I'm really glad to have this conversation. Can we explore that a bit further? Why is gratitude, appreciation, and these other soft skills, many people would say, why are they so critically important?
Well, let me share a story with you that really goes to my background as an equity analyst. One of the things that's always been very fascinating to me, for those that follow the stock market, is that a company we'll all expect that they're going to have earnings of, let's say, 10 cents in any given quarter. And then when the numbers come out at 10 cents, oftentimes the market sort of yawns and the stock trades flat or down. It's only when the earnings beat significantly, like 20% or 30%, that the market really goes up significantly. And so we all understand the earnings game and we trade the stocks accordingly, et cetera, which is fine. But the problem is that mentality, I think, really starts to seep into how we view the employees of our companies and the people that we work with. And yet, if people stopped doing the things that they do every day that we expect for them to do, our companies and our lives, in fact, would actually unravel. And so one of the things, and yet we're not going to go to Cisco and say, gee, thanks for getting that 10 cents of earnings, even though theoretically we should. But we can go to the people that we work with and say, thank you for doing your job. Thank you for being such a good CPA and managing the books so well and the audits so well that I can now sleep at night. That is something that's certainly part and parcel of our controller's job, and yet because he does it well, our company can function well.
Now, but you worked and you still work in this financial industry where so many people have told us, you know, that's just not the way we do business. Why would we talk like that to each other? They know they're doing a good job or they wouldn't be here.
Right, and people will continue to do that, and I think that's certainly a mindset that people can cultivate. It's one that I know certainly does not work with me, and I think most people, I think wanting to be appreciated for what they do can feel needy, but I think we all know, no matter how tough we are on the exterior, we want to know that we're doing a good job, and so when people tell us, we may act oddly or awkwardly, but I don't think it's ever lost on anybody. So, and while I don't have the statistics to back it up, although I'm sure I could find some, in fact, I think there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that when people are grateful, they perform better.
Yeah.
So it's not thanked, but also expressing appreciation.
I completely agree. And Roy and I both have done a lot of research in this area as well, particularly around someone you respect when you get the recognition from someone you actually trust.
Right.
You know,
right.
Big difference.
And in fact, if I can just add something there, I at one point, you know, wrote a post that said something like, "Thank you for talking behind my back." And I noticed that oftentimes you and I hear compliments about a third person who's not in the room. And one of the things I really try to do is when I hear one of those compliments is to pass that compliment along, because then it's twice given. And when you receive a compliment and then pass it along, they know that there's sort of they have no skin in the game, and so it was really genuine. And so that becomes an even more powerful way of saying thank you to someone for being who they are.
You know, I completely agree, and what you just said around that and around the quote you said earlier around, it sounds needy, but I often say this. I say, you know, the sign of being human is the need to be appreciated. That isn't needy. That's simply being human.
Yeah.
That's simply being human.
Right.
Knowing where I stand, particularly vis-a-vis the relationship I have with my bosses and my peers,
mm-hmm.
right? And when you feel accepted in that group, and particularly, you mentioned it with Brooks Lee Bourne earlier as well, right, that when she didn't feel like she was accepted within her peers, not only was she not accepted, she was rejected. And perhaps what she would have implemented and suggested would have changed everything, would have changed the outcome of the entire crisis.
I think it absolutely would have.
Yeah. And so we want to know where we stand with each other. And in fact, that social pairing, if you will, that ability to trust each other has a huge difference.
Right, and in fact, there was an interesting talk that I attended at the Forum for Growth and Innovation a few months back by a professor at Harvard Business School who was talking about this woman who, he was the former CEO of Arrow Electronics, Steve Kaufman, and he was talking about the woman who was his mergers and acquisitions guru, sort of the head of the SWAT team, and she said, whenever we make an acquisition and we go in, there are only three questions that every employee cares about. They don't care about strategic vision. They don't care, you know, if the company's going to make money next year. All they care about is, number one, do I have a job? Number two, how will I get it paid? And number three, who do I report to? Those three questions, if we can answer those, and those go back to that sort of sense of appreciation for who you are, what you're doing, a sense of security, having a place within an organization, and then people will thrive.
So Whitney, we've talked about these things, and a lot of people listening will say, well, we understand this is important, and you know, there's a lot of research to support why what we're saying is the right way to do it. So why is there so much resistance to the concepts, perhaps? And despite the, you know, all this stuff saying that we should be doing these things, it seems like morale has never been lower, at least according to research from Conference Board and, you know, other researchers that say that people are really not happy at work right now.
Mm-hmm.
Why this resistance to doing some of these things as leaders? What's the biggest obstacle, you think?
Because it's hard.
Yeah.
It's very hard. And I think that it's so much, and I think sometimes we disconnect from ourselves, and so we can see what other people need to be doing, but we're not aware that those very things that we're suggesting that others do, we need to do ourselves. We're somehow disconnected from ourselves. A little bit it goes back to the point that I made at the very beginning of securitizing capitalism and ethics. There's something about the two that we need to put together. And so while we can't really legislate or require that the people that work for us do that, we can do it ourselves. And I think, you know, that goes back to the whole notion of leadership. If you have a person who's at the top of an organization who is a leader and who is grateful for their employees, I think you'll tend to see that diffuse throughout the entire system.
It does spread, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I would suggest as well that the toxicity also spreads. Like if you have a leader who's all about themselves.
Absolutely.
And, tries to do false praise, but it doesn't really work on anybody, that also kills their team performance as well.
Agreed.
It's interesting to me as well, you know, that when you see leaders who leave, be them good or bad, if it's a good boss, you might also see other people follow them to the next place because they're saying, hey, it's not about the job for me, it's about working with that particular person. Have you ever seen
Absolutely
groups
right.
that do that?
We don't hire. I'm more and more convinced that we don't go to work for a company. We go to work for a person or you know, we don't hire a company. We hire a boss. And I think that is really true. A good boss can make all the difference and in a very sort of mediocre company.
Yes. We don't work for a company. We work for a boss, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it makes a huge difference. And it's amazing how many of these people, like the good people, when they leave, they actually end up influencing a lot of people to leave with them.
Right.
Mm,
well, I think that's really ultimately the definition of a leader is that power flows to them naturally. They don't command it. They don't expect it. They don't require it. It is just it goes to them as a stream going uphill. It's counterintuitive, but it happens regardless.
Well, it seems like people, well, we all know who the good bosses are and the toxic bosses are, don't we?
Uh-huh.
And we
yep.
gravitate towards those who will give us a future as opposed to those who are going to be like a showstopper from right out of the gate.
That's right.
Did you find this pervasive in your previous work life as well, whether it be at Merrill Lynch or otherwise, where you would feel persuaded or people knew who those people were and you wanted to be with those good ones?
Absolutely. The one boss that I referred to earlier, this boss, his name was Michael Brown. You notice I'll give shout-outs to people that I can be complimentary about. At Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, who's now, he's from Australia. I would have followed him anywhere because he made me feel that I could do my job and I could do it superbly. And so I do think that really great bosses and leaders absolutely engender that kind of respect and following, if you will.
So within this vein, and a big shout out to Michael Brown, I'm sure I'm related to him somehow. I'm going to try to grab some credit here.
Just like I'm related to all the Johnsons.
Yeah, exactly. Like you and the Johnsons, absolutely. And Roy's going, oh, goodness.
Oh, no. Yeah.
But within that vein, to follow that channel, like you said, great leaders, we know them, we follow them, and you would have followed him anywhere. How does being other-focused, if you will, make us more effective? I remember you told a story about doing a recital, a performance mm-hmm. at a university, and you talked about the different outcomes based on whether you were thinking about yourself or whether you were thinking about the audience. Can you describe that a bit more and why other focus is so important?
Absolutely. Only about a month ago, I was, as I said earlier, I was a music major in college. I played the piano, and so I played a recital with a vocalist. It was a cabaret-style recital in an auditorium of roughly 1,400 people. And prior to this particular event, we had played in front of audiences of around 50 people, and every single time, my nerves bedeviled me. To the extent that we would go out and I would play, and instead of thinking about her and, you know, was I listening to her and accompanying her well, I kept thinking, you know, what do they think of me? Do I sound good? Am I going to make a mistake? And I played well enough, but certainly not brilliantly and not in a way that we could connect with the audience. Well, on this particular event with the 1,400 people, something had shifted, and I don't quite know what, but I was able to get to the point where I thought to myself, this needs to be about her, the woman performing. Her name is Macy Robison. And this, most importantly, needs to be about connecting with this audience and helping them feel. It was a recital about motherhood and being a mother. Helping them feel that this really matters and that they matter and what they're doing is valid and important. And when I shifted my focus and started focusing on them and on Macy, everything changed. I still made some mistakes, but there was such a feeling of connectedness with her and with the audience that I would have to say it's been one of the musical highlights of my life. And I wouldn't say that I knew the music so much better than I had in the prior recitals. It was simply that instead of it being about me, it was about the other people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I've certainly had that same experience, and Roy, I'm sure you feel the same, that when we're connected to the audience and less concerned about us on stage making the presentation, the connection is so much better.
Mm-hmm.
And so much, it's actually real, isn't it?
Right, right. And in fact, you know, something I've thought of a lot is it's about connection, not perfection. And if I can focus on that, and that can be my mantra, the presentation goes infinitely better.
Well, I love that. I appreciate your conversation. It's been just so fantastic having this conversation with you. We have to take a quick break, but for all of our listeners, please stay tuned because we will have one last segment with Whitney today, and your generosity and time today, we're so grateful. So we have to take this quick break, but when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Whitney Johnson, president at Rose Park Advisors. For Real Recognition Radio, this is Max Brown and Roy Saunderson reminding you to keep it real.
The future of online TV is here. View exclusive content from your favorite talk radio hosts and new programs that you can't see anywhere else. Visit voiceamerica.tv today.
How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about, getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Real Recognition Radio. We're going to continue our conversation today with Whitney Johnson and learn some final pointers on leadership and the power of gratitude. And Whitney, I made a note earlier on. I don't know if it's going to have any bearing, but you kind of gave that. I think her name was Carol Gilligan. You mentioned an author of In a Different Voice.
Yeah.
And you described obviously some of the more intrinsic characteristics of women, and you obviously made a caution that obviously they need to make sure they learn the technical skills. I'm curious if this. The innate qualities that women have, you would think they could be the best appreciators and recognizers and givers of gratitude over men. Do you see that? Or are they trying to outweigh those natural traits in trying to gain the power in the workplace?
Well, I think that in the best women leaders, we absolutely see that. If you can remember back to the 80s and you saw how women dressed, they dressed like men and were trying to be men and going back to that whole idea of power. And the contemporary
right.
flip side of that is women dressing like women, but with the attempts in some ways to seduce. And both are two sides of the same coin, which is a power play. And so what I would say is that with women that want executive positions, we need to be trained well, really well in the technical skills. But then we have to build on our feminine strengths. And then no one more out of balance. And one of the myths or stories that I often think about as I'm trying to calibrate my navigating this is the myth of Psyche. And let me just review it very quickly. She was estranged from her beloved Cupid or Eros. She wanted to be reunited with him, and she had four tasks that she had to complete, the second of which she had to obtain golden fleece from the rams, which are these huge, aggressive, head-butting beasts. and it seemed impossible, and yet she, instead of going out up against the rams and getting trampled, she waited until they had left for the day, and then she picked up the fleece off the reeds in the field. For me, this is a metaphor for every woman's task of gaining power without losing our innate sense of connectedness. So I always think about that as I'm going after my goals and trying to succeed in the workplace. Am I doing it in a way that will allow me to bind myself to those that I love and that I work with? And sometimes may love and work with it can be the same or not, but like and or love. And if they bind me to them, then I have things in balance. If it's only succeeding and disconnecting that other piece, then I have failed. And I think that's a good metric or rule to live by for all women.
I love the example, and it does bring back memories of Greek mythology, so that's great. That's great. Now, obviously, you know, it's all about how we treat people, and we all know this does have an impact on the bottom line. What can we do, though, when we've perhaps broken some of those relationships? How do we repair them?
Well, I think the first, what we have to want to repair them. And so we have to know that they're broken. We have to want to repair them. And I think that, as with anything, once you know something's broken, if you're willing to read the directions on how to put it back together or find someone who can help you put it back together, you can. And I think it's very much the same, but it requires a tremendous amount of humility, if you will, of saying, you know, I haven't made this working relationship work. Let's figure out how to do that. That's very difficult to do. But if we can, we will be able to, I think, have superior work relationships and superior productivity.
Right. And sometimes, though, we're at the mercy where perhaps we have a negative or bullying kind of boss who obviously mm-hmm. doesn't have that humility. What advice do you give to people in dealing with such an individual?
Well, I guess usually I would say, first of all, I would say if you can leave, then leave. But sometimes
yep.
we can't. And sometimes we were drawn to that. We hired that boss for a reason, unbeknownst to us, you know, sort of intuitively we did. So I think it's really important for us to sit down and figure out, what am I supposed to learn from this person, and what am I supposed to learn from this situation, and try to put ourselves in their shoes, kind of go way over there and see how we can change first. And then once we've learned what we need to learn, then I think it's fine if we move on. But I do think that if we've hired a boss, there may have been something that drew us to them in the first place and a lesson that we subconsciously needed to learn. But then once we've done that, I think then we get to move on and go to a place where we can learn another hard lesson.
It's funny how the doors open when we're ready to close one, isn't it?
Yes, agreed.
That's so true. Now, you must have some exemplars of leaders that you put on your roster to look up to, whether mm-hmm. mentors or just people that you've known over time. Can you give us a few examples of some of these leaders?
Sure. One person that I actually quite admire is Sandra Urey. She's the CEO of Cambridge Associates, which is an investment advisory firm. She's a role model for me because she started out at a prep school as a teacher and then got her MBA as a single mother and now is the CEO of this organization. And during the downturn, they didn't lay off any people. Now, that may not always be the case, but they knew they were going to need these people again. She kept things running. She keeps the pulse of the firm. She's superbly trained technically, and I know people that work for her, and they love working at Cambridge Associates, and they're really the leader in their field. So for me, she's a great example of this psyche piece that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. The other person I really admire is Clayton Christensen, who invited me to partner with him and his son to found Rose Park Advisors. He's a professor here at the business school, and what I admire so much about him is he wrote this article called How Will You Measure Your Life? That's been very popular about a year ago. But what's fascinating about him is that you see him write that article, and from a distance you can say, that sounds all well and good, but is he really like that? And the fact is, he is. Who he is in his public persona is very congruent with who he is in his private persona. I know several of his children. I work with his oldest son, and they could not think more of their father. And that says a lot to me. And so he's another role model.
I think I just was reading some pieces and videos on Forbes magazine about him.
Yes.
In that regard.
Yeah, yeah. It just came on the cover of Forbes this month, yeah.
That's right, that's right. Well, listen, we're getting close to a close, but before I ask my last question, Whitney, I wonder if you might be able to share with our listeners where they might be able to reach out to you and connect in any way possible.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, I blog on the HBR blogs, and so you can, if you Google Whitney Johnson HBR blogs, you can find me. You can email me at my work email address, wlj@roseparkadvisors.com, and I would love to, and you can follow me on Twitter at Johnson Whitney, and any of those ways are ways where we can connect via the comments, via, you know, in a more private forum on the email, or just in the more public cocktail party like world of Twitter.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Whitney. Final point, maybe a short to answer here. What would you say leaders of the future need to do to be successful?
Well, let me tell you two things that I live by. One is, and so I don't know what other people can do, but I can tell you what I can do, is that one of my favorite sayings ever is by Stevie Wonder, who wrote in his song, The Songs of the Key of Life, "You can bet your life and that and twice its double that God knew exactly where he wanted you to be placed." And I love that phrase, because I think as a leader it's very important that we believe that there is something that we need to accomplish, that we can accomplish, that we have the skills to accomplish, that no one else can do, that we are in some small way indispensable. I think that's critical. The other piece that I think a leader needs to have is to believe that the only safe harbor is in our convictions. There will always be someone who is disgruntled by our viewpoints, and if there isn't, then we probably don't yet have enough of a backbone. And I think that's an important trait or quality or aspect of being a leader. And then for me, sort of another one of my touch points is that I want to do good and be good. And I think that a real leader will be someone who wants to do good and be good within their respective sphere.
Wow, that's a lovely summary. I've been writing furiously all these little pointers here, Whitney. We thank you so much for your contribution to our show today. It's been a refreshing viewpoint, wouldn't you say, Max?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much for being part of this conversation and taking your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, wonderful. If people would like to continue to learn more as we delve further into relationships, inspiring greatness, and making better workplace, keep tuning in to the Real Recognition Radio. Tune in for our next show, where Max and I will continue the discussion in these areas. Max and I welcome and, of course, even encourage you to send us your comments and suggestions for guests to have on the show. You can email us at feedback@realrecognition.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Thanks for listening to Real Recognition Radio. For more information about the Recognition Management Institute, you can visit us at realrecognition.com. Until next time, this is Roy Solnison and Max Brown reminding you to keep it real.
Thank you again for tuning in Real Recognition Radio. Please join Roy Solnison and Max Brown again next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for more motivational tips to help your employees perform better. We'll talk again next week.